Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/Wondery, code Wondery.
Graduation is a sweet occasion, but finding the perfect gift can be a bitter struggle. MMS.com has a solution. Personalized M&Ms. Just imagine the look on your grad's face when they receive a custom candy creation featuring their school's colors, name, and even their photo printed right on some M&Ms. It's a thoughtful way to celebrate their accomplishments and make the occasion even more special. Visit MMS.com to create your own personalized gifts and party favors for graduations, weddings, birthdays, and more. That's MMS.com. Use code WONDERY to receive 15% off your next order.
Welcome to the Eddie Tinti Podcast number 1017. If you're in D.C., Chicago, or New York, I will be headed your way to do some stand-up September 5, 6, 7. I'll be at the D.C. Improv. Then the following weekend, September 13, 14, just Friday and Saturday, I'll be at the Improv in Chicago. And then October 3, 4, 5, I will be in New York City at Caroline's on Broadway. If you go to id10t.com /tour, that will get you ticket links and show you some other dates that are coming up. And then also, again, I keep saying this, but we are seriously, it is happening. New products are landing in the ID10T shop, as well as we're going to open a little vintage shirt store because I just like going and searching for old vintage shirts that I would wear. But we'd like to keep you updated on that. And then also, again, with stand-up shows and podcast guests and new products that we have in the store. So please, please, please go to id10t.com/signup to join our email list. You know, in the old days, email lists were the thing. And then it was like, no one likes email lists anymore. Everyone goes to blogs. Then it was, no one goes to blogs. Everyone goes to social media now. But I feel like we're getting now back to... I personally am signed up for a handful of email lists, and I really like them. Just a little daily thing for things that I enjoy. So id10t.com/signup to join our email list. And let's go to the corkboard, though. This is events at id10t.com. We'll get you onto the corkboard. So my old pal Tony Thaxton, who was in a band called Motion City Soundtrack, which was one of the first episodes when we started doing the podcast in 2010. One of the very first episodes was Motion City Soundtrack. And also, we recorded it at the House of Blues, which is no longer on Sunset Boulevard. A lot of changes. But Motion City apparently is going to do some shows coming up. And also, Tony, who is a very funny, talented guy, has a new podcast called Bizarre Albums, which explores the weirder side of music. Each episode's a quick 15-minute listen that celebrates and tells the story behind the strange albums that make you wonder how and why they exist, doing deep dives on albums released by pro athletes, actors, fictional characters, sometimes when bands took a huge left turn. Albums already covered on the show include Bruce Willis, The Return of Bruno, The Simpsons Sing the Blues, and Shaquille O'Neal's Shaq Diesel. New episodes drop every Tuesday on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, everywhere you download podcasts. Great job, Tony Thaxton. I'm very happy for you. Also, Mike Atkins writes, I was wondering if you could mention my album release on the corkboard. It's called Rivers, and it comes out September 3rd. Pre-release is available now on Apple Music. It was really hard to complete because during production, my mom passed away at age 78. Oh, Mike, I'm so, so, so sorry. And I send you so many hugs and so much love. I felt like I needed to finish it for her. That's really beautiful. Mike, damn it, Mike. I'm going to get it right now. You can find more info at mikeatkinsmusic.com. Again, events at id10t.com for your corkboard listing. This episode is Dr. Drew, who I've known for 25 years. Yep, that's the right number. Oh, my heart. 25 years. I met Drew when I worked at K-Rock. I used to fill in on Loveline all the time. And as I've said many times, Drew helped me get sober back in 2003. I'm forever indebted to him. He is a good friend and someone that I adore. So he is promoting the Dr. Drew podcast. He also has the Adam and Drew podcast, the Life You Live podcast, Weekly Infusion podcast, which is the history of opium, which is really interesting, KABC's Midday Live podcast, and the Dr. Drew After Dark podcast and YouTube show. But You can find out about this and all things Dr. Drew if you go to drdrew.com. It'll have the list of everything there. So thanks to Drew for coming back on the podcast, which I always love talking about. I just love talking about the mental health and the mental state of our culture, where we're at. And he's a great guy to talk about that with. So here, and also funny. So here's episode 1017 of the ID10T podcast. Dr. Drew returns.
Initiating ID10T protocol.
Drew's mic technique right now, is this like...
This is how you do it.
I mean, listen, I am a podcaster, but Drew's a fucking podcaster.
Like, getting in. Drew, we are getting in.
Drew, I mean, Loveline really was the prototype for a podcast, in a way. I mean, it was a call-in radio show, yeah, but it was really kind of a podcast.
Yeah, we barely took breaks. We hung out constantly. I mean, it was like, and we were absolutely no awareness that we were doing a radio show.
Right.
And you know, I do a daytime talk show now on AM radio, and I'm acutely aware of breaks and call letters and promoting ahead and resetting and blah, blah, blah. We never did any of that for 30 years on Loveline.
No.
Never. We just chatted.
Well, especially because K-Rock particularly, I mean, I remember this from working there. They're very much like, don't sound too structured.
Don't sound like a radio station.
Because we're supposed to be like the anti-station. Yep. So it was, everything was supposed to be loose. You were supposed to, like, when you were talking over the beginning of a song, you couldn't do it too tight to the first beat. You couldn't do it on the...
Don't make it sound good. It's really what they're telling you.
In a way, yeah. Like, they like to kind of, when you'd, like, rifle through papers and be like, oh, what's going on?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, which is weird because... And it used to drive Corolla crazy because he wouldn't adhere to that idea of the sort of the doors opening and people coming in. And he made him very upset. Well, partly because he has a little son of ADD or something. But he didn't think it sounded good. So he'd get very... And I was like, look, I've been doing this for 20 years like this.
It's so funny. Just thinking of you and Adam sitting in the Loveline studio, and then your powers of analysis just start turning on each other.
We do a podcast.
I know that.
Every day. And that has morphed into pretty much 80% Adam abuses Drew.
Right. Out of love. He loves you.
Anymore.
He loves you.
Is that what that is?
It is. It's funny the things that like burrow under your skin, you know, just like the things, you know, when you think about all of the responsibilities that you have
as a
broadcaster, as a podcaster, as a physician.
Yes, a lot of stuff gets to me. I was up all night on Tuesday night worrying about a patient.
Well, that's – I want to hear stuff like that because that's nice to hear that a doctor's worried about a patient.
I was bothered and troubled, and I didn't have a good sense of things and an answer, and I had a plan. Well, I was just troubled all night long. So my whole week was screwed up by that.
You know, I say that to my therapist sometimes. I'm like, you know, how do you – because I don't think I would be a good physician because I would just absorb
Well, being a good therapist, it's very different. So that's a really interesting point. Which is that your therapist has to sit and hold a boundary, right, and be deeply attuned to what's happening to you and completely open and present to your experience, but not to have a contagious – not to catch it and not to be overtaken by it, whatever you're experiencing. That's the skill, right, being able to hold a boundary and hold a frame of closeness at the same time. This isn't that. This is you're presented with a challenging, complex medical and psychiatric case, and you're trying to figure it out, and you're trying to do the right thing.
So you're having your house moment.
It's rarely like that because essentially everything on House was like a routine medical problem they made sound like something bizarre.
But I mean, it's not lupus.
It's more that how do you help this person get where they need to go, given the complexities of problems and the situation with families and the whatever their willingnesses are to participate in their own care? You know, in my world, when people use drugs and alcohol, they're often unwilling. to participate, you know? And so it gets very, I just get too much. It's codependency. It's what that is, where I feel like I got to solve this. I got to make it better, which just reminds me, a patient just texted me something else I forgot to talk to him about.
Oh man. Well, there's driving. You just have, I mean, in addition to the normal entertainment responsibilities, you actually have actual like people's lives hang in the balance for you. That's the other thing, is the pressure of like,
That is a hard job. There's no harder job than being a general doctor. I'm telling you, an internist or a psychiatrist. They're really hard jobs. It's so hard.
Yeah, I had to. I had to go to the doctor today because my stuff. I think I ate something weird a couple nights ago, and then every couple of days I've been getting these waves of stomach cramps.
Mm.
And so I just went into the doctor today, and it's like he's trying to solve it, poking around. Okay, it's not that. Or you don't have a fever. Your white blood cell count's fine. You know,
good.
It's just go on a bland diet, you know. But
what were you experiencing?
It was just this like stomach cramping.
Cramping?
Yeah, just like, just like waves of like right here.
Why don't you get an endoscopy and see what's going on?
I don't want a fucking tube shoved up my...
Not up your ass, down your mouth.
I don't want that either. But, you know,
here's what you should do.
He wasn't overly concerned about it. And my doctor, by the way, personally, I think he overtests. But this time, he's a tester.
That's the reason. He put you on Pepcid or something?
He was trying to put me on something called Zantac, and then something called like Donatol.
Yeah.
Which is, I know pharmacy had.
It's not used anymore.
So
don't do it.
Yeah, I won't.
Let me tell you, the main ingredient in Donatol is phenobarbital.
Oh, so, that's not good.
Yeah, but it was a good medicine for cramps. It was good for that back in the day. But let me advise you on something that I think everyone should hear about.
Yes.
I'm very hot on.
Please.
Which is genetic testing for risks for cancer. Mm-hmm. You know, people test for BRCA, right?
Yeah.
BRCA1, BRCA2, but there's also 28 other genes that we should be tested for. And I heard about this. I don't remember how I heard about it. Probably because of my prostate cancer. So I thought, I better test to see if it was any genetic thing. I beg your pardon. My sister was tested and she had something. And I was like, geez, I better get a test. I have something called Lynch syndrome, MSH6. So I'm at high risk for stomach and colon cancer and prostate cancer. And so now I have to have upper and lower endoscopies every year.
No.
And my sons had to start having them at age 25.
Oh, my gosh.
But the point is, if you came in with that stomach pain and you had a Lynch, you would get an endoscopy. You know what I mean? God. So you should do – it's a spit test. It's just called – it's color.com. It's called COLOR.
You know, my wife and I have talked about the genetic testing.
Why wouldn't you do that?
Because – there's a couple things. There's a couple reasons. Number one, she's like, I don't want someone. We're basically, who has the rights to our genes, to our genetic maps? First of all,
I don't care.
I know, but second of all, I also do think that there is a little bit of a chicken and an egg with a, you know, a self-fulfilling prophecy or
dude,
like it.
I have prostate cancer. I got tested for a genetic predilection that I have that also includes colon and stomach, which I can prevent. I had a hunch I needed I was pushing the screening more than the insurance wanted to pay for. It's normally every 5 to 7 years. I was pushing like every 3 to 5 because I had a hunch it was in my family and stuff. And then this now, insurances pay for it every year. They want me to get it every year.
God, no, but then what's going to happen is...
What's going to happen is I'm not going to get the cancer.
No, you won't. Happen. Yes, I know, but I'll get results back. And it's like, oh, you might be predisposed to get this. And then every time I get like a slight headache, it's got to be this thing.
I see. You don't trust yourself.
I don't trust my own hypochondria to be able to...
Ooh, that's a different thing.
To sit through it. I don't know if I can separate and go, well, I'm glad I have this information. You know, like, I just don't know if I can do that. I think it just might be too...
Chris, I'm
worried about you. I'll just stew
you
on
know,
it.
Send it to me and I'll worry for you. So, I'm really good at that. Oh, my God.
No, it's fine.
Am I driving you crazy? I'm holding the mic. Is this okay? Okay. Right. Ask your engineer if I'm ruining things for you.
No, Drew is holding the mic in a way no one ever has.
Well, it's like a
sort of like rock star. Yeah, he's holding it like a mic stick. He's like, there's little like spider legs on it, and he's gripping them from the bottom and really...
turning it into a mic stick.
Yeah, you are. But, he didn't seem overly concerned about the...
No, the stomach pain.
But it's fine. Well, I'm glad I'm not going to take the Donatol. But there's something else that's being sent over that's supposed to relieve...
Bentil, I'm sure it is, or something like that.
Maybe something. Or Or heroin, right? That's
That would stop the pain.
Well, I know because do you do a podcast about opiates now?
I do. I have two things. I do a podcast with Bob Forrest, guy with the hat and the glasses from Celebrity Rehab, and we end up talking about opiates a lot. But I did a whole series on the history of opiates, a 14-chapter series on opiates all the way back into the Sumerian times, up through the first American epidemic in the 1890s, and our current epidemic and how we perpetrated this thing and what mistakes we're making now, which is the same mistakes we've always made. We're doing it again.
Because I don't know how I stumbled upon this, but it was probably in some sort of like a today I learned on Reddit that in the early 1900s heroin was prescribed to children as a cough medicine.
Yeah, sure. Bear.
Yeah. But it's just like the little bottle that just says heroin in the fancy old-timey font.
It was good cough syrup. And no, you're laughing because you think of it as a bad molecule, but the whole idea of bad molecules to me is just ridiculous.
Sure.
It's just ridiculous. Fentanyl's a bad molecule, and yet we use tons of it all the time clinically.
Right.
You know, LSD, bad molecule, except it may have some real utility someday for somebody.
Sure.
So all this stuff is, to me is just... It's all chemistry. It's all just chemistry, and there's no good and bad chemistry.
Right. It's just the application or the expression.
Yeah, and the biology, our genetics, and our relationship with it, and what it does pharmacologically to us, and that kind of stuff. But let me just finish on the opium series. I then turned it into an audiobook, and with each chapter, I have interviews with like world class historians. Or people who have written for years about the history of opiates or the big epidemic in the 1890s and or the people that developed methadone. I've these interviews all throughout this audiobook, so it's really good.
Oh, that sounds really great.
Good. Yeah, it is good.
I mean, and it is it the kind of thing where we haven't learned anything?
we plus ça change, right? We're making the same mistakes all over again.
Right.
We're back in 1890. We were treating alcoholism with morphine because it made the alcoholics less noxious.
Sure.
We were treating morphine addiction with heroin, treating cocaine addiction with heroin addiction with cocaine.
So they were aware of addiction back then, and it wasn't just because I just assumed like back then people just didn't really talk about these things, but maybe they – I know there were opium dens. And,
yeah, they knew what an addict was then. And there's – I remember I used to read to my – I used to give lectures to alcoholic groups every week. And there was an 1899 article. JAMA had this thing 100 years ago today. And in 1999, they published this thing that described the disease of alcoholism. So we think now maybe this thing is a disease. 1899.
Wow.
It's like, well, there you go.
Yeah, did they recognize it as a physiological affliction, or did they think it was a mental affliction? Or
genetic, biological.
They thought it was genetic?
Biological, with social and spiritual and whatever, but clearly they were describing it as a genetic biological disorder.
And do we still believe that? Or
yeah.
We still... So
not a belief. Medicine has nothing to do with beliefs. It's all about... What are the facts?
It's about facts and truth-seeking, but as we discover more things, more truths become revealed.
Science is all about disproving.
How many fucking times do you see an article that's like, eat carrots, they're good. Oh, it turns out carrots are bad for you.
Nutrition,
no, eat carrots again.
You can't say much of anything about nutrition.
Yeah.
It's a vastly complex. If you want to hear about nutrition, read Kate Shanahan's stuff. She's a biochemist. She's a physician. The areas where things can be said, she says it. Everything else is bullshit. Mm-hmm. Everything else. It's too complicated.
Right.
We just can't say much yet. And by the way, genetically, we're all different. It's just very complicated stuff. But back to the disease model, right? So everyone has all kinds of opinions about diseases, not diseases. And where I start that conversation is first, how do you define disease? Like you can't know what this pen is until you define what a pen is, right? So let's come up with a definition for disease. Ready?
Yep.
You got one?
Oh, do I have one?
I'm just asking.
Molecular yuckies?
That's a piece of it. That's good. I like the colloquial framing. So it's a complex relationship between the genetics of the individual and the environment. So always gene environment interaction.
Yep.
That results in an abnormal physiology. We call that pathophysiology. That pathophysiology is expressed through signs and symptoms. So guys like me can see the signs and symptoms and determine that the pathophysiology is there. Those signs and symptoms will follow a predictable pattern. We call that a natural history. And guys like me also try to change that natural history in a positive way. Mm-hmm. We call that treatment. So it's gene-environment interaction, abnormal biochemistry, signs and symptoms, predictable natural history, predictable response to treatment. That's it. That's disease. All disease. Every disease. All diseases.
Where does mutation figure in? Like we're cells.
Pathophysiology, genetic pathophysiology. And mutation, you know, yes, if you have Tay-Sachs or something, you at least have to live. The environment has a role in the sense that you have to live long enough to that genetic mutation to develop. There's always some input from the environment, more or less. It could be a lot of gene or a lot of environment, but there's always some of both.
I was really hoping that it would kick in around puberty and I would get Wolverine powers, but that did not happen.
Silk is a possibility.
Oh my God, that's so great. Now I'm going to do that genetic test and be like, where do I score for Wolverine-ism?
Your beard and your nails a little long, I'm noticing. So I'm just saying. I heard a little sound of knives.
Mm-hmm. Yep,
I didn't know what that was.
Yep,
but so that's disease. And then people go, oh well, alcoholism is not a disease. Well, does it fit in that model? Well, it's genetic always. Is there an environmental component? Sure, mm-hmm. The usual trauma or you know some sort of maybe an affective disturbance, access to alcohol. These are all environmental components with the gene. The pathophysiology is well worked out now in the brain. We know exactly where the brain is being affected and how it's being affected. And we certainly know the signs and symptoms. We certainly know the natural history of alcoholism and how it's likely to go. And we know how to treat it. Mm-hmm. And we know how to improve the natural history. The only viable consideration that could call that model into question is whether alcohol is less of a disease and more of a syndrome.
Okay.
Like hypertension is a syndrome, right? It's high blood pressure, multiple causes.
Right.
So hypertension is not really a diagnosis. Essential hypertension is a diagnosis. Renal vascular hypertension is a diagnosis. But high blood pressure is just a finding, right? So hypertension is just a syndrome caused by many different things.
Okay. And so alcoholism could be a syndrome caused by many different factors. Right.
Exactly. And so – but still, the biology is so – common. It's so we know exactly what's going on,
right?
In terms of the activation, the binge reward, the dysphoria when you come out, it's just all worked out now. So it's hard to deny it.
But there is, you know, but you do know, like when you're in recovery, like, oh, the drinking was a symptom. Like that's a sort of an accidental expression of what the addictive mind will do. Sometimes sometimes it's drugs or sometimes alcohol, sometimes it's sex addiction, sometimes it's
symptomatology.
I'm curious to know, because I sort of have this idea that, you know, people have such unhealthy relationships with their devices and with social media now.
Really bad right now.
That I do wonder, like, in 50 years, are they going to look back and go, Jesus Christ, like the way that we looked back at when people worked with asbestos in their house?
Yes.
You know, and go, were they doing?
I think so. And let me tell you the evidence for that, which is that teen and particularly young female suicide is skyrocketing right now.
Oh, Jesus.
Skyrocketing. Young people are unhappy. And it seems to be, we don't know yet, but it seems to be a combination of helicopter parenting, not getting them out of the house, you know, not letting them go to where, just get out of here, go scram, play in the yard, and then the screens. And I have a feeling, my sense is, and again, no data yet for this, but my sense is, A, screens make you compare yourself to other people all the time. The recipe for unhappiness for human beings. Mm-hmm. There's all this data on happiness that shows humans are very, very happy until they see somebody else that has more or looks better. Then we get unhappy.
Right.
Freaking Instagram is. And by the way, all the teens report Instagram is the most onerous part. So Instagram is a perfect place for comparing, right?
Sure, because each social media platform has its own performative qualities to it. But Instagram is, of course, very visual. Like, look at my idealized
Just look at mine.
Look at mine.
Yeah. And then what about mine? And that's a recipe for unhappiness. So there's that. And then there's the usual, you know, being an adolescent and not understanding your identity and what's going on and then having that rain down on you.
Sure.
Then I think there's another piece, which is I think the boys are into their video games and their pornography and are sort of lost in all that and are not unhappy in it. Let's put it that way. But they're sort of lost in it and they're disconnected from development and they certainly aren't dating.
Right.
They certainly aren't forming and breaking relationships. They develop no skill with that during adolescence. And I think the young females, I think you help us with this. We have a female in the room here. I think females are really reliant on social connection for their happiness. Now, all humans are, but I think the female, particularly adolescent or adult, is exquisitely sensitive to that. And because everyone's in their screens, they've shown that young girls, like adolescent girls, are not visiting each other's houses the way they used. They don't go visit each other. They just go back to the screen and lock themselves in the room. I think that is adding to the depression, and that's creating the suicide.
Well, and it is, it's this self-sustaining machine, because we as humans have needs to connect, needs for community, needs to belong.
100%.
But it's kind of like zero.
That's disconnect. I'm pointing at the phone. It's not only a fake connect. It's no connect.
And then you add on top of that that people can get shit on and bullied and trolled and made to feel inferior and
on top of everything else.
On top of everything else, and it feels like it's. You know, this thing that should have been so great and so powerful and so connective is isolating, and also plays to the worst, and not only to the worst tendencies that people have, but also the worst insecurities that people have. And I don't know. I mean, I don't want to sound like an old man here, but I don't really know what the solution is. But that sort of. That addiction to hearts and likes and engagement it feels like it's just wired directly into this back door into our brain that makes people not think as logically as they should.
That's absolutely true.
And so are our brains being rewired, and can it be unlearned, or is it, you know, like how much is this going to affect? How much do you think this will affect people going forward, and when will it end?
Well, it has to end because it is so problematic, right? It's really, really rough right now. How it ends and where – so I think it ends by parents learning to restrict access to these things, and that's going to have to happen. So this negative impact on the developing brain and on young adolescents and young adults, we can interrupt that pretty easily with parenting, right? The part that concerns me is the part that adults are subjected to, which is a whole other spiritual bankruptcy, which is the behavior of the mobs and the bullying and all that stuff you mentioned.
Yeah.
That's what the adults get. And it has a different impact on us. It just ruins our lives. It just makes us feel terrible.
Yeah. I mean, it really, I don't know. It's really concerning because I don't think most people would think of it as an addiction, because it's a digital, like it's still so new in when you look at the timeline of humanity,
we're just learning what it is.
And it's infinitesimal, we're doing it before we even. And listen, I'm not completely shitting on it. I do it,
I do it too, and I let my kids. Well, I guess my kids really didn't have it. We kind of lucked out. Pre 1995, you didn't really have to deal with it the way you do now. Born pre, yeah. Post 1995 rather, but you can't not do it. It's not something that the horse is, the genie's out of the bottle. We all got to do it. But there's got to be some humanity brought back into it somehow. I don't know what the answer is. I see the parenting side. That's sort of a clearer thing. On our side, I mean, I liken it, on adult side, I liken it to what the European cities did in response to the mobs that used to form in the medieval times. They just made the city squares smaller, so people couldn't congregate. So if you know, some of the squares are pretty small, and that's why they did that.
I don't know. I don't have kids, so I apologize for speaking out of turn on this. But is there a way to instill young people? And I know that there are some things that the best parents in the world are still going to have problems with their kids.
Sure, of course.
But how do we instill confidence in our kids and in other people, and let them know, like, hey, you're enough. You don't need. How do you make them feel like, regardless of however many hearts they get on a post, that they're still that they're good enough.
Yeah, that is a general function of good mental health you're asking about, which is about having enough time in an intimate frame with a primary caretaker.
Sure.
That's really what that is.
Yeah.
Our brains need that to grow and develop. We have not emphasized that. That in order – like one of the reasons that people do drugs and alcohol, you referred to it a little bit earlier, which is you're unregulated. You don't feel good. You can't. You're too feelings are too prolonged, too intense, too negative. You're looking for a solution to feel better, right? Mm-hmm. And why do you need to feel better? What's happening? It's not usually depression. Depression, people go get on antidepressants and they do things like that, or they withdraw and get through it, or whatever. But unregulated emotion is a whole different phenomenon. So feelings are sort of that you're not comfortable in your own skin is sort of a way of thinking about it. And that's dysregulation. That's called dysregulation. And it turns out the process of our brains building the emotional machinery for regulation is worked out. We know how to do it. We know how it's done. And it's done in what we call intersubjective exchange. It's done in a setting of close proximity of two bodies in space, mm-hmm. in space, not on screens, mm-hmm. where one body's having an experience. The other body attunes to it deeply and just responds, offers something metabolized back, even soothing maybe. Or if it's joy, amplification.
I mean, I would imagine that from an evolutionary standpoint, it would have been necessary for humans to develop that to form communities and to want to build societies and civilizations that we do have an innate need to be around each other.
We're screwed without each other. We're
in the world. But is there a rise now? Because knowing nothing about anything, I would probably venture to guess that in the last 20 years, maybe 10 years, 20 years, that there is a particular rise in that sort of cluster B malignant narcissism scale,
100%.
Which includes narcissist personality disorder, borderline personality disorder, sociopathy, antisocial, you know, like, is it,
I watched it happen.
And so it's not just that we're more aware of it now. Do you feel like it really is more
Here's
prevalent?
My evidence. Here's my evidence. And again, people debate whether it's really happening or not, or are we just calling it this or whatever.
Right.
But here's what I saw. When I started, you know, I worked in a psychiatric hospital for about 35 years. And when I got there in 1985, every patient would get a form with their diagnoses on it. Mm-hmm. And there's something that used to be called Axis 1, which is like depression or bipolar or whatever. Axis 2 is where the diagnoses go, the personalities go, which mm-hmm. is what you were just talking about. And I would walk around the hospital. I would see all the medical patients, so I'd see everybody. And I'd look at their diagnoses, and the personalities were all over the place. I saw obsessive compulsive disorder personalities, paranoid personalities, dependent personalities, all the cluster Cs that you never see anymore. It was all over the place. And all of a sudden, I noticed it started just more commonly being the cluster Bs, and started the cluster Cs I didn't see so much anymore. And then only cluster B. Mm-hmm. Only.
What's in the C? What's cluster C?
Dependent. I can't remember them all anymore.
Because there's
A, B, C. You know, and this was the other ones just vanished. And I'm telling you that those kinds of psychiatric cases that had those disorders, we were not seeing them. They were not coming in the door.
Wow.
It wasn't that the doctors were just diagnosing them differently. I saw them. This was all cluster B.
Right.
Everybody. And I thought, wow, that's meaningful. Now, I think what did that was all the trauma that adverse childhood experiences, we now call that, or childhood trauma. I think we had much more of a pandemic of that than we realize. And that changed the personality structure. I think that's it. And now that we're all that way, and that we've all done our narcissistic parenting, which is the next layer of doing this to kids. We first get injured narcissistically with trauma. We become narcissists, and then we do narcissistic parenting to create some more narcissists.
Right.
Well done. And now we've got mobs and envy and tribalism, and that's all the liability of narcissism.
But also, do you think that because algorithms are basically creating these hyper-curated worlds where we sort of feel like our opinion is – because when you open your device and it gives you all the stuff you already like, I don't know if people necessarily think like, oh, this was hyper-curated for me. I think they think, oh, what I'm seeing – the world is a reflection of exactly what I think.
Right.
That probably – doesn't
horrible
help
horrible
and Amazon can tell you it's like we can get anything we want at all we live like spoiled pharaohs in a lot of ways where we can get anything to any other point in time
there is I haven't figured out yet there's something to that There's something about that. I'm not sure. We have like too much.
Well, right? I think it's, you know, like I think it we're in danger of all becoming like King Joffrey, you know, where it's...
Yeah, King Baby, we call that.
Yeah, which is basically, you know, that if power corrupts, then we have absolute power now because we can summon anything we want and because of that thing and because we can get into a confirmation bias loop about anything that we believe, we can affect anything we want, you know.
And you add to that... We've not been well educated for the last 20 or 30 years. We've not been carefully, you know, analytic thinking is sort of out the window.
Yeah.
And so we don't have good objective logical frames that we can automatically call upon to evaluate ourselves. We can't step back and go, let's think this through.
Right.
We're not accustomed to that. We don't have the discipline for that.
Well, you know, like when people are posting on social media, what tends to get more engagement? A well thought out statement or like an emotional, high stakes, super extreme point of view? I mean, I know that's not always the case, but...
pretty much.
But the algorithms, again, the algorithms... The algorithms prioritize that.
I see Chris running outside. The algorithms! Ah!
The algorithms freak me out because it's like they prioritize that, you know? Yeah. And then people see that and they don't necessarily realize like, oh, this is an algorithm prioritizing the like this sort of upvote culture. And again, I really, you know, I'm careful. I don't want... I feel like I shit on social media a lot, and I don't mean to. I do.
Oh, let's do it.
I believe it has uses. It has good uses.
I mean to.
I know, but I don't want to sound negative all the time. But I just it's just something that I hope people are aware of, because if you just look at social media, you might think this is the full scope of the world, and that's dangerous because it isn't. There's more.
It's not even close.
No.
It's nothing.
And I just don't want people to, you know, like. Because if people do have generalized anxiety or generalized depression and feel that sort of disconnect and feel the discomfort in their own skin, they might not be realizing that this sort of passive engagement is stoking a lot of that.
Not only that, but the stuff that you're seeing fly by is not the average person's feeling, and it's not important. And so what's important, again, is going out, getting some fresh air, listening to some music, spending time in closeness with people that actually care about you, expressing how you're feeling, and all that stuff melts away in a second.
Right.
When you really get back into human engagement.
Right. I mean, it is, you know, it is that sort of convenience is the road to decline kind of thing. It's like everything's so convenient, it's like, we don't need to leave our house. Netflix, we got Netflix. I can just text my friends. I don't have to go say, oh, we were going to meet then, but I just don't feel like, you know.
Yeah.
We'll just have everything delivered here. Mm-hmm. You know, we won't get out of bed. We do it constantly. And, you know, like that
it's
sort
nice
of...
It's nice here, though. I want to stay here. I'm not leaving. Although that badger freaks me out a little bit.
That's a Wolverine.
Whatever.
Yeah, that's a little Wolverine. It's a little vintage taxidermy Wolverine that we have in our
beautiful.
House. Yeah, our house is basically just like a creepy old museum, which we love.
Yeah,
we absolutely
I
love.
Dig it.
I love anything with a story. I just love. Like all the furniture is antique. It's like this table had a story. People sat here before us. You know, we're basically just curating these things through time, and then they'll get passed on to someone else, and then they'll get to...
But the point well taken is that it's the human experience that you're interested in.
Absolutely.
It's not the furniture, although it is pretty nice.
and are we kidding ourselves that we can achieve human experiences through through non-human platforms?
You can't. You're not going to. It's not... Bodies in space.
Robots can't love you.
Yeah. I believe that we're going to have sort of a – like we had a decade of the brain, we're going to have a decade of the autonomic nervous system or of the body or something.
Sure.
Because our body – we got multiple brains essentially distributed through our body.
Mm-hmm.
These, you know, nervous webs of parasympathetic and sympathetic material, we have no idea how they work. Some people call them chakras, things like that. But they're clearly important, especially the one over your chest. I mean, but that is where I suspect most of our, you know, we have gut and we have heart, feelings.
Mm-hmm.
That's where feelings come from, is our body. And feelings are important.
Mm-hmm.
And connection with feelings is enhanced by connection with other humans.
Especially because in communication, the words you use are a small part of communication. Communication is body language.
It's probably spectacularly small. Probably way more small than we have.
So if you're just texting someone, that's right.
Most of the interaction that we're just unaware of it.
Right.
It's just two bodies in space relating, attuning. Probably you could watch our blood pressures and pulses and pupillary hippus kind of start to time together when we get really attuned.
Yeah.
And start connecting. And that's magic. How the fuck does that happen? I'm suddenly Shaggy from
dude.
No, I'm suddenly insane clown posse. Magnets, how does that work?
Fucking magnets. I think it's funny. It's like we have the parasympathetic and the sympathetic and the feelings, and we have these line up, and then how does that fucking work? Like, I think that's great. I see the phenomenon all the time where, you know, like everyone's had the experience where you shoot someone a text and they write back like two or three words response, and then all of a sudden you build a story in your head based on own baggage, whatever it is, about what exactly was going on, and then you find out.
Well, but we're similarly constructed that way. You know what I mean? I know exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah,
I'm not sure everybody does that.
Really?
Overthinkers, like,
yeah,
you and
people
I
who are sensitive, because yeah. and then you find out, like,
a lot, as you point out, a lot of people are close to me, don't give a shit.
Someone's like, oh, I was in line for something and I just wasn't. And you're like, oh my god, I built this whole thing where I thought you were upset because I said this, and then you said that.
That's codependency, dude. That's codependency.
Ah, fuck. No, you're right.
Yeah,
you're right.
But I gotcha.
But I do think a lot of people. Well, maybe it's just a lot of people in this business. You know, like there's a lot of.
Well, there's a lot of stakes, so therefore people are jumpy.
And also particularly sensitive, vulnerable, sensitive, especially, you know, that part of the codependency. It's like, I just want everyone to be happy. Can't everyone just be happy? Can you guys please just stop yelling at each other?
You know what I'm super grateful for is that, you know, working in radio and television a bit and enjoying it and grateful that I get to do it and hopefully making a difference doing it. But I'm so glad I had another job before I ever did that. It's a nice perspective, I must tell you.
What else are you grateful for? Let's talk about the things we're grateful for.
Gratitude is very important, right?
It's impossible. You can't live without it. I mean, you can, but it's not a very...
Well, I tell you, when I'm with people and they begin speaking about gratitude, I know I'm around somebody who's doing okay.
Yeah.
Because gratitude is an extremely important feeling, and it's one that you tend to have when you're doing what you want to do, and your things are
right.
You may not be doing exactly what you want to do, but at least you can understand, you can have perspective sufficiently to be grateful for what you got.
Well,
I'm grateful for so much. Oh my god! Oh my god!
I prattle on about this quite a lot, but I do find that as I get older, this idea that you have when you're younger of like, if I get to a place that it's the if then, if I get this thing, then I'll be happy. If I accomplish this, then I will be happy. And at a certain point, you're like, you know, we're not alive forever. It's that sort of stoic idea of memento mori, of just sort of like remembering your mortality and like, this is life. Like, you have to enjoy it.
You should interview Ryan Holiday on this podcast.
I had him on.
Okay, good.
And he was phenomenal.
Yeah.
Like, I fell in love with his...
Do you know how he got into Stoicism?
Through you.
Isn't that weird?
Yes.
So weird.
That's right. Yes. He came up to you at a lecture when he was, like, in college.
And I was reading Epictetus. He goes, what are you reading? I go, this guy, I'm trying to figure out Epictetus. And he went to it and he just never looked back.
Yeah.
I don't really like Epictetus, by the way.
Oh, you don't?
I'm not a super fan of but anyway, it helped Brian.
He's
written some great books.
Is it and so what was your journey with Stoicism?
Mine is just part of philosophy. I've been really somewhere around 15 years ago, really when the availability of lectures online and all that kind of stuff came up, I noticed some weaknesses in my education in terms of history and philosophy, and I just started really focusing on getting an understanding of it. And I started reading in a lot of philosophy. And at that point, I was reading Stoic philosophy, and I'm very steeped in Aristotelian philosophy, but I've gotten off into all kinds of other weird stuff. There's a podcast called Partially Examined Life. You ever seen this?
I haven't ever looked at it.
It's great. Like, I've been a guest in there a couple of times, and so has Ryan. And that's really now where I geek out on my philosophy stuff.
Well, it is. I mean, when you think about, like, you know, each day, this is what I have to make out of this day.
Well,
I
tell you what got me into it. It's that what got me into it, I would describe it as the limits of medicine. There's many times when I can't do anything for a patient, and I have to adopt some sort of philosophy, some philosophical approach to the care of the patient, even though I know I can't make them well. Mm-hmm. And that was a very, that was the zone I started sort of looking at philosophy from, like what, and Seneca said it this way. He said, you know, man should live as long as he should, not as long as he can. and that's kind of what I was feeling with patients, where I could keep them alive forever in these suspended states and misery. And I was like,
which isn't really
like,
living.
Like, what's the philosophy here? What are we doing here? I need to like have a frame to understand what I'm trying to do and see if I can get the patient or the family to adopt a similar frame. Now I'm really pretty good at that, thankfully, because I've done a lot of thinking about philosophy. And so I understand the difference between, like Seneca said, living as long as you can versus living a good life as long as you should. And I think the former, the latter, is much more important.
And did that help you with your own cancer? Or does it all, like...
No, that was, God damn it, why am I sick? that was a little bit of a shock, because I was like, really? I knew I'd get it by the time I was in my 70s, but 50?
Come on!
No, that I was in, that was more an issue of gratitude. Because if I got to get a cancer, I'll take that one any day. Prostate cancer over so many other really bad ones.
Right.
Yeah. So I was grateful for that. I didn't like it, but I was grateful for it.
And then getting through that, did you, even as much as you've been around, you've been a third party to other, you know, for decades.
Yeah, yeah.
But did you feel, was it a transformative experience for
you?
Was
I a good patient?
Were you a good patient? And did you feel like you came out the other side stronger, better, more appreciative?
So this is back to the Stoic philosophy, right? No, it was shitty.
Yeah.
but I probably take a little better care of myself now, and I probably more grateful for some things. Yeah. So there was net.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I just, you know, Drew's holding the microphones, and if you could see the guns on either side
here.
That's
genetics.
Come on. You must.
I mean, I work out, of course. But I mean, the reason I have big arms is really genetics more than my workout schedule.
I mean, you know, Drew, you're in amazing shape.
Thank you. I feel
like every year that we can hang in there, like a whole group of dudes our age sort of falls off the wagon. You know what I mean?
Yes,
where they're just like, fuck it. But I'm just – and it's not that I think, you know, for me it's just more about – I have this fear that of getting to like age 75 and just being all like twisted up, and it's like, if you had just stretched, if you had just,
it's not that simple.
God damn it.
I think if you, you know, avoid alcohol and tobacco as much as you can.
Done. I can avoid that a lot.
And exercise reasonably well.
Done. Like
reasonable diet. You pretty much optimize that kind of thing.
Well, that's good.
Yeah, and just keep it going, though. That's the other thing. Keep it going.
Well, I had high cholesterol. I found out I had high cholesterol a couple of years ago. Mm-hmm. Oh, you do? Mm-hmm. And I don't know if it's genetic, and I don't know if it's that I was drinking Starbucks chai lattes two or three times a day, which it turns out sugar's very bad for your cholesterol.
Sugar's bad for everything. I think sugar and starch way worse than fat.
Yeah.
Humbly.
And is it because it's processed, or is it just bad?
No, it's just not. It's just too much.
Why do we fucking want it so bad?
Because when we had lived on the savannah and needed every damn calorie, it motivated us to grab these high caloric things that we would come upon once a week in the form of a fruit or something, and we would love it.
Right.
But now we can have Snickers every hour or continuously, and we're not wired up for that genetically.
Yeah, and again, I think some of it also goes to the rush of, you know, like when I really do believe that the root of a lot of our problems is this kind of like generalized anxiety and depression that we're constantly running from and trying to distract ourselves with, that is continuing. And you know this from being an addiction specialist, but if you have anxiety and you self-medicate, you know, like you medicate with alcohol, that makes you feel better in the short term, but in the long term, it creates more anxiety, which makes you drink more, which creates more anxiety, which makes you drink more. And so it's the same kind of thing with... We have this generalized anxiety and depression. We're constantly trying to distract.
But that's you're now back to my theme of dysregulation.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. So there's a way to regulate.
And what is that way? Like, what can
sit and be of service and pay homage to other human beings and lead a good life?
Yeah.
Right. Which, how are you conceived of that? I have my own ideas, and it, you know, by good it means having a skill, having some wisdom, offering it to other people.
Mm-hmm.
Being genuine in what it is in that person that you're offering to. Mm-hmm. That's a really tough one. That's a kind of an art form. And just be in intimate contact with other humans. And, you know, and if you have a dysregulation that's above and beyond, then get therapy for somebody who knows how to sit there and wire you back up again. I did it for 11 fucking years.
Like you took therapy or you?
Yeah, I was in therapy for over a decade.
Wow.
Yeah, I had a little kind of alexithymia. I was like, had difficulty finding emotions and tuning to them. And a lot of anxiety. And workaholism, severe. Mm-hmm. And I went to therapy and it was changed my life and changed my instrument so I could be of service to other people.
Well, that's good. I think it's helpful. I hope it's helpful for people to hear, like, even someone who is an expert in these fields still had to have the presence of mind to say, like, oh, wait, maybe I'm not the best I
was,
can be.
I was at that stage, that was probably 20 years ago when I started therapy. I was just beginning to, was it 20 or my kids were like, it was 24 or 5 years ago. And so I was saying, I didn't think I'd really started full bore in the addiction medicine stuff yet. I was just really getting into it. Mm-hmm. And I was aware that I was codependent. I was aware I was getting like cleaned up by certain kinds of personality styles and certain drug addicts. And I couldn't seem to hold the boundary. I couldn't hold it. And I figured, well, that's not right. I should be able to prove that. And I had anxiety and workaholism and stuff. And it was actually one of our sons needed brain surgery when he was one.
Oh, my God.
And I started having overwhelming anxiety, like crazy stuff. And my wife called me one day. I was at work at the hospital. And she goes, you need to see a therapist. And I go, yeah, I know. I really want to. I'm going to. And she goes, you need to see someone. And I was like, I got a chill down my spine. I went, I hear you. And I immediately called and got a recommendation.
What is the, is anxiety a byproduct of basically just survival instinct? Is it just lizard brain stuff? I know like it's, you know, like I know there's the gift of fear, you know, it's like, it's good to, but why is it so
anxiety is
out of control?
Anxiety is free-spun fear, right? It does not have an object to it necessarily.
But it'll find an object and
focus. And there may be a thought or some concern. There's no, in a sense that it's designed to keep us from that badger over there. That's right. What it's designed for. But we have essentially three systems in our brain. I'm gonna put this thing and make it work. This stand.
The microphone
stand.
He's been gripping the stand for too long.
Now
maybe doing
serious
pulses with the biceps
there
at the
go.
Same time.
There we go.
So,
we essentially have we kind of drop through three systems when we are threatened. One is fight or flight, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we drop from that into freeze. And the freeze response is associated with dissociation, where literally our brain floods with endorphins and cortisol, and it's that feeling out of body or in a dream state. That is not a good state for a young brain to be in, particularly repeatedly. It has all kinds of developmental problems associated with it. But it's that dissociation, I think, is always right behind the anxiety. I think it's people that have a lot of anxiety sometimes have some kind of dissociation from some part of their feeling landscape. I know I sure did.
Mm-hmm.
And so the anxiety just flows along, and it's not quite sure what it's anxious about because it's just kind of disconnected from everything. Some people call it alexithymia. And then on top of that, we have perfectionism, and we have high stress, and we have little sleep, and we have a lot of caffeine, and you add all this stuff on top of it, and the anxiety is spiraling, man. And then some people, when they're depressed, part of the biology of the depression causes anxiety. And some people, we don't know why this is true, the anxiety triggers depression.
Right.
You know, I'm in the depression triggers anxiety camp. When I was in college, I had severe anxiety. I didn't even realize I was depressed. And then I started having panic attacks on top of that. I mean, disabling panic attacks. You ever had a panic attack?
Oh, yeah.
They're fucking horrible.
Yeah, I got my first one in college. A sort of pre-internet era, so I didn't know what it was, and I thought I was
having a seizure,
having a heart attack,
losing your mind,
because you
these
can't.
These are all the thoughts. You're like, what's going on?
And then after after a few months, I was afraid to leave my apartment because I didn't want to be out in the world and have it happen.
Yeah. So
and then a friend of mine just said, oh, that's a panic attack. I'm like, what? And he goes, yeah. And that helped.
Yeah, it helps to know what it is. I knew it was something psychiatric because I went immediately to the mental health thing. But it kind of goes from panic to generalized anxiety to agoraphobia. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of what was happening to you.
Yeah.
You were like too freaked out to go outside.
Yes, because I didn't want to
That's your thought. The thought is I don't want to get a panic attack. But the reality is I don't want to go outside.
Yeah, so it might have been. But as soon as he told me that, and you know, like anxiety is the insidious spiral for anxiety is a breadcrumb trail of what ifs. What if this happens? What if this happens? What if this happens? And the stakes get bigger and bigger and bigger.
It does. I think my sense of it is, in most cases, though, and you tell me if this is you or not, is, and this is true of the brain generally, we have all these effed up feelings, mm-hmm. and then our frontal lobe tries to make sense of it. Oh, yeah. It's because I'm anxious. It's because I'm worried about this. You sort of attach something to mm-hmm. it. And then that amplifies it, and then it starts chasing.
Yeah, it's almost like your brain is scanning. Yeah. It's almost like SETI, you know, the search. Yeah. It's like it's scanning the deep space of your mind, and then it, you know, then it's I can freak out about that, and then your brain, and then it expresses itself. But a lot of it, I think, is also overstimulation.
Yeah,
which you know is probably helps explain why something like conspiracy theory is on the rise so much. It's like there's just too much information. People's brains have to sort all of that disparate information and create these insane, you know, stories that are mostly not true.
Right. So it's sort of three things. Lack of actual knowledge in the area. Mm-hmm. So inability to have judgment about it or evaluate.
That's a Dunning-Kruger study.
Dunning-Kruger. I think so tell them what Dunning-Kruger is. I love Dunning-Kruger.
Basically, the long and short of it is
what's the guy from American Idol that was so horrible, that Asian guy?
Oh, William Hung.
That's Dunning-Kruger.
Yeah.
That's a perfect example of Dunning-Kruger. It lets you stand up and perform and think you sounded great and you were horrible.
Well,
that's Dunning-Kruger.
It's basically people who tend to know less will claim to know more, and people who know more will tend to claim to know less. And it basically, the less you know, it's almost like you're too ignorant in a topic to know how ignorant you are.
Exactly. So, and then when you know a lot, you start to feel like an imposter.
Right.
You start to feel like it's too much. There's just so much to know. No one knows it all.
And you see a lot of this on message boards or like on Reddit or something, where someone will just post a very detailed, well, this is why this is it. And then someone else will go, yeah, I work in this field and none of that is true.
Right.
And it.
But because of the cognitive the cognitive distortions, they'll still find a way to justify their thoughts.
Yes.
Even when somebody who's got judgment and expanded knowledge in the area goes, here's why that's not true. Oh, they'll come up with some way of twisting it.
And it's sort of the difference between, you know, if something happens to you in the world and then you react however you're going to react versus having a reaction and figuring out how to distort the world to suit your feelings or your worldview
Okay, so that's the second thing, which is intuitive thinking. When people think from a feeling state rather than a logical state.
And they know. They're like, I know this. But that's not true, though.
I can't trust the government. I can't trust those guys.
Yeah.
So, of course. And then it feels right intuitively.
It's the only answer you can come up with. So it must be 1,000% right.
So it's the Dunning-Kruger. It's intuitive thinking. It's lack of proper education so people can be analytical, and then it's the massive volume of information that just floods through. And I've always tried to figure out, well, how would I make a flat earther come on over to the, you know, to reality?
I don't know. I mean, there's just no –
Well, there's something also comes with kind of the backfire effect too, which you can convince somebody on a narrow topic by really, really nailing them down on the facts, and then they'll backfire and double down in the other areas of the same topic.
Yeah, because the other thing that's very difficult is that I'm sure that once you've fused a belief system to your ego, it is – most people are not really in the business of going – I was wrong, you know. So it's like
you fight to keep that
intact.
Well, now we're back to the cluster B personalities, aren't we?
Right.
And so this is a bad thing. This is a really a bad thing, because I don't like to be very 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 logical in my thinking. I always stand back and look and evaluate. And I was having a discussion about those MAGA hats today on the radio, mm-hmm. and I said. My partner was saying, well, listen, I think people should have the right to wear whatever they want. It's the First Amendment. And if it offends people, it's too bad for them. And logically, they should be, you know, logically, they should be able to wear whatever they want. And the history of this is not as severe as the history of some of these other things, like swastikas and hoods. And, let's say I'm at a dinner table and I don't mean anything by it, except I want to recreate jobs in America. That's my, and she had all these rational reasons for it. And my response was, yeah, but it's hurting people.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't wear it then.
Right.
That's totally irrational. That's totally codependent. It's totally intuitive. And I will not wear it. If somebody says, and the other thing is, I don't want to be perceived as make America white again or racist or anything like that. I understand some people can overlook that. I can't. But I don't want to hurt other people.
Right.
That's intuitive.
Right.
That's not logical. But I would never wear something that would hurt other people. It doesn't make sense to me.
I agree with you. Yeah. I wouldn't want to. Yeah. Whatever it is, someone's like, oh, this thing you did really hurt this, you know, this thing you said.
Oh, my God.
You're like, oh, my God.
Yeah.
How do I? I'm so sorry.
I think you're even a little worse than I am, but I'm very much that way. I'm very much like that. That just bothers me. I want to do good for people.
Right.
That's all I'm interested in doing. And when something I do goes bad, it's devastating.
I still think it's a good way to live. I mean, I think it's a pretty good way to live because it means
I do too.
I think a certain amount, maybe like a shade of codependency is good because it sort of keeps you checked in with other people and puts their feelings as a priority.
Okay, so back to my therapy.
Yeah.
All that liability, that stuff, that sensitivity, and that being wiped up by the people with borderline personality and things like that. Now, because I can hold a frame, I still have that same codependency and that same tendency to be sensitive, but I can use it. It's an asset. Mm-hmm. I'm exquisitely sensitive to what's going on with other people, but I'm not overtaken by it.
Right.
And I can differentiate my feelings from another person's, which I had trouble doing that for a long time. People would evoke stuff in me that I thought was theirs, but it was mine.
Right.
Yeah, for people that are healthy, that may not be such a – that may be a strange thing to say, but for people like codependent, it's a very common thing. And so now I value all that we're talking about. I really value it. And so I take no, I have no problem saying some codependency is good, as long as you can manage it.
Right. I mean, the point where you're essentially sacrificing your life,
you're overtaken. Whenever you're overtaken by other people's stuff, it's like,
because that doesn't help anybody. Because then it doesn't make you good.
It's exactly right.
You can't if someone else is having an experience and you absorb that experience, and now you're both having that experience, you're kind of selfishly taking their experience away, and you cannot be of benefit to them.
It's a classic example of bad parenting. Because parents will sometimes, be so upset about what's happening to their child that all their stuff is activated. That is not what your child needs.
Right.
That is freaking your child out.
Right.
They need you to be calm and present,
right,
and containing, and give some soothing affects alongside of attunement.
Right.
You know.
So what it, is there a way for people to, besides going out, besides interacting with other human beings in the real world and making efforts, sort of navigating the anxiety, the depression, the cluster Bs, it's like, how do we, when so much of that is essentially elevated and we're all opting into that
with the phone.
Yeah. And so how do we find balance? Like what little thing can someone do once a day that, because I really do believe in this sort of cumulative idea of like, if you feel like your life isn't where you want it, you can't change it overnight. Don't try to change it overnight.
That's true.
Small.
Good. No, I've never heard people articulate that. That's good advice. So start with that. Good.
And then just little bits at a time, just make small changes that
totally
are cumulative.
Because
then over time, if you're consistent with those, that will open the door to other changes.
Sometimes when people are depressed and I want to see if they need medicine or not, I'll just say, try it. Let's take some walks. Let's exercise. Listen to some music. Listen to some let's see what you can do.
Right.
Just pulling yourself on up out of this with these little changes. I agree.
Right.
So things like working out, listening to podcasts, listening to music, I totally support.
Yeah.
I think that's very healthy. And then the other part is a little dicier, what you do and how you hang with other people. But I think it goes under the heading of time.
Mm-hmm.
Time with people that care about you and you care about. I think that's the fundamental sort of push.
And spend time.
And
the fucked up part is that I'm sure there's people out there who are like, well, there isn't anyone in my immediate circle that I feel that way about, that I trust, that I can look up to.
There always
is. So I'm going to go on the internet.
Oh, There always is. There's always somebody. The problem is, you know, it's not that easy to reach out. You know, people are busy, and I get it, and that's the world we live in. But there's always somebody. We all have people that care about us.
Everyone's busy, but we're not always doing stuff. It's like we're busy. There's busy work. You know, you're like, oh, my God, I spent 3 hours on Instagram the last guy. You know, it's
no,
like,
that wasn't, don't do that.
That's not going to
help. It's a bad sign. We notice that the phones tell you how much time you spend on this
which is yeah. Which I think is a kind of a gift.
It's a nice idea. I don't think any of us pay attention to it.
I look at it. I mean, listen, you can't – you really need to get the data so that you can then try to manipulate
yeah.
it. You know?
It's like, good okay. if you're that kind of person for sure.
Right.
I'm not sure I am.
So we were talking a little bit earlier about the gratitude. You said I'm grateful for tons of things.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
as we're sort of like winding this down, let's end this on a positive note because I don't want people to feel attacked. It's really concern for just what to me feels like this general sense of.
I think we were fairly prescriptive,
right?
So I think people can hopefully cling on to some of that stuff.
Yeah.
Gratitude, forgiveness, these are really important emotions. If they're being right-sized, all that, you know, simple, having a simple life. Every time I hear people about having polyamories and all this kind of, I'm like, oh boy, it's hard enough to have one relationship, you guys. It's infinitely more complex when you bring more people in, but whatever, have at it. So to have a simple life, gratitude, forgiveness. And gratitude, you know, is such a simple thing. It just takes a minute to take a beat and look around. And there's always stuff that you're grateful for, even if you just had a good night's sleep.
Yeah.
Or you can really examine what you're eating, like be conscious of what you're eating. It's like the way the Buddhists always say, you know, mm-hmm. like be in the moment and just be grateful for what you've got there. I'm grateful, personally, I'm grateful for my kids. I'm grateful for my wife. I'm grateful that we've been together all this time. I'm grateful that I'm healthy today and I can work out and sort of try to optimize my health. I'm grateful that I can make it. I'm grateful that I have a skill that can make a difference for other people. That never gets old. This is something that a lot of people miss. When you know, you want to be of service, to really be of service in a way that you feel really good about, you got to have some experience and some skill in something. And that's a part that people often leave out. I know that I have lots of friends that have big careers and made a bunch of money, and they're like, "Well, now I got to go do something." I'm like, "What are you talking about?" and they really skip the part. Well, if you want to be a nurse, you got to go train as a nurse, and you'll have that skill then, and you can go do all kinds of cool stuff. But you can't just. They don't want to hear from you anymore. You raised your money and whatever, and maybe your money can do some good, but that isn't the same as that one-on-one service. You know, having a skill that changes the trajectory for another human, extremely grateful
for
that.
And also maybe try doing it and, like, don't really tell people about it.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, of course, it's good to raise awareness for causes, you know, if you have a big platform of social media. But, you know, at what point are you doing it? Because it's for the other person, what point are you like, well, this is going to look really good on my feet.
Okay,
you know?
So I'm glad you brought that up. Whenever I see people doing it publicly and big, I don't begrudge them that at all. I'm glad they're doing it because it's needed.
Yeah.
But I always think, oh, that's
maybe
that's
some that. maybe a percentage of it is.
And don't expect to get the same out of it, of great gratitude, personal gratitude, personal fulfillment, as if you had just gone down and tied the shoes of some kids that or done something. Even then, if you'd had some skill, if you spent a couple years developing a skill and then went deployed it for one individual, that is way more powerful than millions of dollars for some cause. Don't hold back
still
on the
good.
Cause.
Don't still
hold back.
Good to do that.
You do it,
and but it's a
different kind of thing. And in terms of gratitude, you'll feel great, much more gratitude from that one-on-one kind of thing. And again, one-on-one where you have a skill to offer another person. And then this crazy weird thing I've been on in media. I didn't know I was going to do that. It's so weird, but it's been so fun, and I'm so grateful to take my skill and have a way to sort of apply it in these creative ways. This is all a gigantic surprise. I'm sitting in Chris Hardwick's house talking.
I mean, of course, yeah,
but
I arrived.
But all of it has been just. It's all still weird, but I've been paying more attention to it the last couple of years. Going, okay, this. You're sort of getting towards the end here. Let's focus on it, see what you can do. So.
Yeah, I got some interesting advice once about it, and it has a lot to do with, and I think this is applicable, but basically, and this might be codependency, but I think a lot of people do this nowadays. It's that idea of letting your emotions be affected by where your emotional core has an external locus versus an internal locus. So like events, the outside world, the external world determining your happiness as opposed, and this is also somewhat stoic, I would imagine.
Yes.
Versus the internal stuff. And someone said to me, I go, yeah, you know, I get if something really good happens at work or something, you know, I feel really excited or I get really, you know, like charged or joyful. And they said, okay, great. Take that, internalize it, and separate the external thing that happened and just feel the joy.
Oh, well, that's interesting.
Just
I like
feel
that.
The joy detached from the external thing so that
if you can get good at that, that's a pretty good skill.
Yeah. And so it's like that blew my mind because it is so easy. Like our world is so external now and it's so on display at all times and it's so so overstimulated that just those simple things of just being able to sit with yourself and just feel joy is a fucking skill set, you know, but you have to cultivate it. It doesn't, you know, unless you're just pre-wired, it doesn't just happen on you.
I can't do it without other people. I have to have that. That's me. That's my thing.
Yeah.
I have to have, I sort of experience myself through other people, out in the person than me.
Right.
And so I have to have that. That's sort of how I'm wired. It's weird.
It's shocking that.
I wish I could do that. That would just own the, contain the, whatever feeling it was. And maybe I'll work at it.
No, I have so much respect for people who can help other people. And again, it's that like the, I'm pointing like you knew that I recorded the podcast there, but sitting right over there, recorded the podcast, you know, with this homicide detective named Joe Kenda, who's been on a couple times. And Joe's amazing. And, you know, he's solved all these murders in Colorado Springs and he's an incredible guy and was an incredible homicide detective and still deeply affected by everything that he saw. He said, you know, and he's just fine. I mean, he seems fine with it, but he has like a series of recurring nightmares. He has to sleep in a separate room from his wife because he can't sleep all night.
Oh.
And, you know, it's like that, like someone who's willing to sacrifice that much of themselves and still feel satisfied, like, but I did this for other people and I would not change a thing. I mean, that is so inspiring and so incredible, especially because, you know, this business that we work in is, you know, it's like, yeah, you do dance on the line of narcissism because you're basically, hey, I'm walking into, I want strangers to like me
there's a narcissistic impulse in all of this, for sure. But it, as long as it's contained, I don't want to be.
Not at the expense of another.
Narcissism, my opinion about narcissism, it has liabilities.
Sure.
The liability of narcissism is envy. Mm-hmm. You have to knock other people down if they have more than you, and empathic failure. So if you lose, if you're a narcissistically inclined and you lose connection to important feelings and more importantly, other people's feelings, that's a problem.
Yeah.
That's when narcissism is bad.
I am, for whatever reason, I'm lucky I don't have the envy thing. Like
I don't have it at all. It's mysterious to me.
I like watching people succeed.
Yeah, me too.
I root for, like, I want people to do well.
Yes. And if somebody has something more, I'm like, God, I'll have to work hard to get like
that's
them.
Exactly it's right. Like that's where I think, that's what I think is healthy competition. It's not to achieve at the expense of other.
It's not a zero-sum game.
It's not a zero-sum game, and you don't need to destroy other people in the process.
No.
It's like, oh, wow, that was really cool. That inspires me to try this thing.
It's the way it always was throughout history until we got this narcissistic turn. Then it all became screwed up.
Well, I really hope that that people come away from this just at least thinking a little more about things that they don't realize are choices in their lives that are affecting the landscape of their emotional and mental health.
Well, I would also say that most of what you think, most of your thought processes are dependent on feelings. Mm-hmm. And what you think is going on is really being generated by feeling states that your brain is trying to make sense of.
Right.
So pay attention to that.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, we do kind of live in an opinion is fact era.
Exactly.
Where it's like, I have this thought, and so it's a fact.
It is
like,
so.
Well,
it feels like the earth is flat, therefore it's so.
You're assuming a lot for that to be true. Maybe there's other, you know, maybe there's other explanations.
But you're good?
I'm good. Yeah.
Okay. You seem good. Yeah.
Yeah. Feel.
I love this place. It's fantastic.
It's really fun. Yeah. The wife and I spent a lot of time restoring it.
I see it. It comes through.
Okay. Here's all of Drew's stuff. I mean, it's
all drdrew.com. It really is all there.
But still, Dr. Drew podcast, the Adam and Drew podcast, the Life You Live podcast, Weekly Infusion podcast, History of Opium, which you said was a limited series.
Yeah.
KABC's Midday Live podcast, and that's then Drew After Dark in the YouTube show.
Oh, yeah. I'm starting something with Tom Segura.
Yeah.
It starts like next week.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah, good timing. I forgot about that. Yeah, we're going to be deconstructing their crazy-ass videos at your mom's house and deconstructing comedians.
Oh, fantastic.
Maybe I'll have you as a guest on that.
Yeah, I mean, listen, comedians do enjoy talking about themselves.
Yes, they do, but we're going to try to deconstruct a little bit. Christina has a preoccupation with that.
Deconstructing comedy or deconstructing like...
Well, we'll see. But mostly Christina P., you know, is Tom's wife. She keeps going, why are they so... They're all on the dark side. They're all a mess. We got to figure it out.
Well, comedy is a defense mechanism.
I think so.
You know, like it's how we protect ourselves from...
And it's a lot of... And comedians always super smart and super interesting. Like really have interesting life experiences almost always, except Corolla's a robot. Even his, though, you've heard his life. You've heard why he's a robot a million times. So,
well, it is always a pleasure to see you. Thank you so much for being here.
Pleasure.
And again, I will never stop telling people this every time you're on, but when I wanted to get sober, I called you. You did not hesitate to put me on the right track. You checked in with me. Your genuine concern, when you got nothing more out of it than just knowing that you were helping another person, you know, help change the course of my life. And I will always love you and be appreciative to you for helping me.
I appreciate it. And, you know, that kind of stuff keeps me going. I'm ready to go for another few weeks just with that and your recovery. And I'm grateful.
Well, thank you so much. I am grateful, too. And I hope you all are grateful out there. Maybe just write down one thing you're grateful for and just look at it and feel it and try to absorb the joy.
Yeah.
And as always, enjoy your burrito. And amor fati, as the Stoics say.
Did he give you the...
I have the coin.
I got the
coin. I got the fucking... I got that. Because I said to him...
Not just to live... What misery, but to love it or something?
To love fate.
Not just to accept it, but to love it.
Move with it. The end.
It's the ID10T podcast number 1017. That was Dr. Drew returning to the podcast. It's time for word salad wrap. Okay, I'm talking a lot about the dangers of social media. And not in the, like, you know, when I was growing up, it was all about the dangers of backward masking on albums, you know, because it was the 1900s, and that's how rock bands influenced us with their satanic messages, by playing the records backwards. I just mean, listen,
This podcast is supported by FedEx. FedEx offers fast delivery, more visibility, simple returns, and weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. population on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. With FedEx, you get picture proof of delivery, ensuring you always know where your package is. Returns are simple with packageless and paperless returns. Plus, FedEx Ground is also faster to more locations than UPS Ground. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. So, what are you waiting for? See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively, FedEx.
Social media in and of itself is neutral. It's really just how we perceive it, how we use it, you know. And so I don't mean avoid it. I do think it is a part of our culture that does not seem to be going away anytime soon. But I just mean how to approach it healthier for yourself. Because again, I do think, you know, the more you're on it, the more it just... by either comparing yourself to other people that you see or just toxic news cycles or shit that's going on in the world that is, you know, just chews away at your soul, that it's just about balancing that stuff. And so here's what I'm going to recommend. And by all means, tell me to fuck off. You do not. This is just a suggestion. But as I've said a few times before on the podcast, I had been playing so much Nintendo Switch, literally like... well over 200 hours of Zelda Breath of the Wild. And so this year I thought, you know, I want to apply that same amount of time and see if I can learn guitar, piano, Italian. So I started becoming a student of things again. And it's been fucking great. And
part of the way that I was able to do that was to, you know, bargain with the time that I was spending playing video games. I thought, well, if I take, you know, like 250 hours and apply it to a new skill set, what would I be able to learn? What would I be able to achieve? And so far, it's been really fun, like just amazing. So this is my challenge that I pitch out there to you, all right? There's a good chance you probably have an iPhone. If not, no worries. I'm sure your other non-iPhone phones can do a version of this. But just see if you can track how much time you're spending on social media per week, per day. And just take a few of those hours and swap them out for a new skill set. You know, so if you see that you're passively spending like 3 hours a day on social media, which is, by the way, sadly not an unreasonable amount of time that people spend on there. Like, that seems like it might be kind of the norm, at least, you know. Maybe just bargain away one of those hours, you know? Or if you see, like, Jesus Christ, 20 hours a week, that's a fucking part-time job. I have a part-time job in social media that doesn't pay me anything other than just I get get paid in kicks to the gut. So maybe if you see, like, okay, so that's 20 hours a week I'm passively spending on social media. And when you go to reach for your – sometimes when I go to reach for my phone to just start scrolling through Instagram or whatever, I instead grab a guitar. And I just start practicing the pentatonic scale. It's something to do with my hands. It engages me. I immediately forget about the other thing, you know, about going to social media. If it's a language, you know, you go to pick up your phone, instead of opening a social media app, open a language app. You know, allow yourself to spend, you know, if you're spending 20 hours a week on social media, if you just spend even 5 hours a week trying to learn something new, you're going to have a new fucking skill set in not a lot of time, my friend. So I just think a way to sort of combat like the passive poisoning of our souls and our brains is to learn a new skill set. You'll be inspired. It'll start taking you in directions that you never thought possible, that you never dreamed you would go. And then, you know, you'll see pretty incredible results after, you know, 1 month, 3 months, 6 months, even a year, which goes by like that. It's already fucking September. September in a couple of days. How are we in September of 2019? Time marches fast, especially when we're distracted all the time. So distract yourself with learning and knowledge and take on a new hobby or a thing that is edifying to your soul. And if you can't think of what it is, then just start trying stuff. Pick up a guitar. Pick up a violin. You know, start learning, I don't know, learn Japanese or like just anything that allows you to create rather than to destroy your heart and your soul by wasting too much time on social media. Create the balance. Then maybe trade off some time with yourself. Okay, so if I do an hour of learning this new thing today, then that is my, you know, payment to myself. That is my reward to then go, you know, spend an hour on social media, whatever it is. So, you know, once you kind of track the data and see how much time you're spending, what and where, then it'll allow you to manipulate that time in ways that can work for you instead of just passively eating away at your life. So I hope any of this makes sense. I hope you try it. And if you do, let us know how it's going. Send us an email at whatareyoulooking@id10t.com. The at is just the at symbol. Was much more clever when I came up with the name for the email, and then I realized that I was going to have to explain that every time. So I apologize. That was my fail. And also go to id10t.com/signup. Sign up for our email list to get updates about live shows and new products in the store and podcast guests and all that and exclusive whatnots. So thanks again for listening. I will see you in your ears next week. And as always, I appreciate you. All right. Have a good day.
ID10T scanning complete. Enjoy your burrito.
For more than two centuries, the White House has been the stage for some of the most dramatic scenes in American history. Inspired by the hit podcast American History Tellers, Wondery and William Morrow present the new book, The Hidden History of the White House. Each chapter will bring you inside the fierce power struggles, the world-altering decisions, and shocking scandals that have shaped our nation. You'll be there when the very foundations of the White House are laid in 1792, and you'll watch as the British burn it down in 1814. Then you'll hear the intimate conversations between FDR and Winston Churchill as they make plans to defeat Nazi forces in 1941. And you'll be in the Situation Room when President Barack Obama approves the raid to bring down the most infamous terrorist in American history. Pre-order The Hidden History of the White House now in hardcover or digital editions wherever you get your books.